I don't know if you remember where we were exactly in the study of Genesis when we stopped last, but we are in the middle of the experiences of Joseph, and the Lord has worked dramatically and providentially to bring him out of prison, to bless him with opportunities and to bless him with gifts that have immediately catapulted this man to a position of great prominence in the world and a great opportunity for greater things to come. And the story begins to unfold as we come to chapter 42. This is the story of the first visit that his brothers make to Egypt during the famine. They're going there, of course, to find food, but the Lord has a lot of greater things in store for them as we work our way through this chapter and the next few chapters. Really, what is happening here? Obviously, we see God's providence at work in a lot of the details. And throughout the stories of Genesis here at the end, we have been picking up on so many evidences of how the Lord is behind the scenes orchestrating all these things to put people in the right place at the right time to accomplish the specific purpose that he had in mind for them. And, of course, our concern has been with Joseph and something of his own personal life and his personal circumstances. He's suffering unjustly. He's down there in the prison. He is falsely accused. And it's been great. It's been a blessing to see how the Lord, through some surprising means, restores him and does some very unexpected things in his life. But there's still this issue, this big issue hanging. What about his relationship with his family? And as you come to the closing chapters now, the focus broadens away from Joseph. And you remember that Joseph is one in a pretty large family and a family that has been just torn apart by all manner of deception and cruelty and a lot of other things going on between the members of this family. We have seen this family go through times of devastation because of immorality. We have seen them really risking their very existence because of their cruelty toward the people there at Shechem. We have seen all this infighting among the brothers. We have seen a father who is clueless about the effects of his favoritism on the relationships between his sons. And it is a little bit alarming when you recognize that this is the chosen family. That in all the world, these are about the only people that could be called the people of God. And this is the kind of legacy that they have left. And this is where their sins have led them. And nevertheless, God in his mercy is doing a lot of things coming up here to bring peace and reconciliation among themselves. And we have been trying to keep before us this theme of God's redemptive plan. And so much of it so far has been God is working through the nation of Israel that is getting started here to bring all families of the earth to himself, to reconcile people and put them in a right relationship with God and make them useful again for him. But what we're recognizing at this point is that the redemptive plan has got to have as well some horizontal effects. Because sin has not just disrupted our relationship with God. And it has done more than just corrupt us individually. Sin has had dramatic effects in society. And even in the societal unit that you would think would be the most close and the most trustworthy and where there would be the most warmth and the most chance for a normal relationship, at the family level, even among the people of God, things are just broken apart because of sin. And so we're looking at a dimension of God's redemptive plan that hasn't been too much of a focus yet. And yet, as we go on, we see the Lord's providence working on that level as well. It is just getting off the ground in chapter 42. There's going to have to be a lot of other things happen before this thing is all patched up and things are totally restored. But very encouraging to see all of the movements toward reconciliation that take place in chapter 42. That's our theme as we move forward tonight. Now, this chapter breaks up pretty simply according to geography. And if you look at verses 1 through 5, you have the brothers of Joseph over in Canaan. If you pick it up at verse 6 and read all the way down to verse 28, that is the real meat of the chapter, and at that point they're in Egypt. And then the closing verses, 29 until verse 38, you're looking at these men back in Canaan. Those are the main moves. And as we think about this theme of reconciliation, as I have looked at this, it really seems that there's a particular issue going on, reference to reconciliation, something a little bit different in each of those sections. If you think about this family, if you think about their need to be reunited under God, what is it that we're learning about God's work to reconcile people to themselves? His own people to themselves. What is it that we're learning about that in each of these little sections? And I think it's clear as we move on that there is an individual thrust, starting off with verses 1 to 5. This may not always be the case as God is at work, and it may seem to be sort of out of sync with the concept of redemption, but the thing that really gets redemption started on this horizontal level is trouble. It is adversity that initiates reconciliation. And I'm thinking there especially about the famine that prompts the circumstances of this chapter. Let's read these few verses and we'll move on. When Jacob learned that there was grain for sale in Egypt, he said to his sons, "Why do you look at one another?" Most of us get in a bad mood when we're hungry. And there seems to be a fair amount of tension in this family. And evidently the brothers, in addition to all the infighting that's gone on, are not particularly active and really searching for a solution. And the father has to sort of release some energy there to get them moving. They're just sitting around looking at each other. And he said, "Behold, I have heard that there is grain for sale in Egypt. Go down and buy grain for us there, that we may live and not die." So there is this extreme threat, and this was the case all over the world of that time, but it's affected the people of God. In other words, just because they are part of this elect redemptive line, they have not been spared from the suffering. It's not as though it were raining, you know, over their tents and everything else was dry. The people of God have not been spared. They very well could die. This is a desperate situation. And yet, you look at what God's doing there and ultimately throughout the world in the famine. And I'm sure God was accomplishing 1,000 things through that. But there's a sense in which this was the main thing he was doing. He had to bring the whole world to its knees so that he could get the attention of this one family and move them from point A to point B. It's not the way we normally think of catastrophe and of suffering in the earth or in our lives. And who knows what God is doing as events befall people generally or as adverse circumstances come into our lives. Maybe one of the things that he is doing is putting people in certain circumstances that are going to force them to deal with unresolved problems in personal relationships. That's what's happening here. So, verse 3, 10 of Joseph's brothers went down to buy grain in Egypt. But Jacob did not send Benjamin, Joseph's brother, with his brothers, for he feared that harm might happen to him. Thus the sons of Israel came to buy among the others who came, for the famine was in the land of Canaan. And before we move on, I do think there is something that is reflected about Jacob's continued heart problem. In the way that he responds, there is so much of this chapter that is dialogue. And And the author is telling you certain words that these characters spoke, because those words are a window into their heart. They're very carefully chosen words. And in this case, he makes sure we understand, Jacob said, Benjamin's not going because I'm afraid. I'm afraid that something's going to happen to him. Well, do you know how long it has been since Joseph supposedly was killed? He was down in Egypt suffering for 13 years. And then you had the 7 good years, the years of plenty. And now you're at the front end of the 7 years of famine. It's been 20 years, a little more than 20 years, since the whole incident with Joseph back in chapter 37. And this man is still gripped by fear. And furthermore, why didn't he say, keep back Reuben, the firstborn, because something might happen to him? Why didn't he pick any other sons? Why did he hold back this one? Well, of course, Benjamin was the other son of Rachel. And this issue that God has been driving at in his life about preferential treatment, about favoritism, it is still, it's not been dealt with. And this man continues to cling to his idol, I think we would have to say, within his family. And I believe that through these circumstances, the Lord is working to deal with that as well. So, the circumstance that gets the reconciliation process started is actually suffering. It is adversity. It is difficulty. It is extreme need. And I don't know, maybe somebody tonight would want to think about your circumstances in that light. We understand that Romans 8:28, God works all things together for our good, and it's all a part of the process to conform us to the image of Christ, but perhaps there would be something specifically that he's doing on the human, the personal level to reconcile some ruptured relationships. That is often the way that he works. Well, when they finally get down to Egypt, and you get to the longest section of this chapter, there's a little bit different emphasis as far as reconciliation is concerned. We could say that adversity is all the way through here, but particularly when Joseph begins to deal with them, and he begins, under God, as God's agent, really, to get at what was going on in the hearts of the brothers to resolve this problem, there is a definite emphasis here on the concept of testing. Testing precedes reconciliation. Adversity gets it started, but it's not just trouble in general. It is that specific circumstances are there as a test to bring issues to the surface. All right? Teachers give tests because they want to expose the knowledge or the ignorance of the students. They want to make it plain to the student and to themselves what's happening there. And at this point, the Lord, through Joseph, is testing these men. He's working to bring out something that is vital in order for the reconciliation to take place. So let's read, starting at verse 6, and make a few comments along the way. Now, Joseph was governor over the land. He was the one who sold to all the people of the land. When I read that, I really was a little surprised, because it would seem to be that somebody in such a position of importance would have all kinds of people working under him who could have taken care of the day-to-day business of dealing with these people coming for food. And I'm sure he did have people working for him, but evidently he was very much of a hands-on sort of a person. And he was right there in the thick of it. And again, we see him doing something a little bit unexpected, but in the providence of God, at the right place, at the right time. I mean, what if he had not been there? And some underling had taken care of the brothers and sold them food, and there they go back to Canaan. And yet here is the prime minister, you know, engaged in this in this sale and this bargaining process, and God has something that he's doing through that. The verse goes on. Joseph's brothers came and bowed themselves before him with their faces to the ground. And now you're going to get into a series of back and forth conversation. It moves along, getting more and more specific. But first of all, verse 7, Joseph saw his brothers and recognized them, but he treated them like strangers and spoke roughly to them. "Where do you come from?" he said. They said, "From the land of Canaan to buy food." Now, that's the shortest little dialogue that takes place here. And yes, we know the end of the story, but again, we've got to put ourselves in the position of a first-time reader. That's a bit surprising as well. That seems out of character for Joseph. You know, you think of him as this patient and loving guy, trusting God. And after all these years, his brothers show up and he speaks roughly to them. And he starts to interrogate them. And it just gets worse in terms of the way he's treating them. And you're wondering, what's happening here? There is suspense for the first-time reader, because this is not what you would have... I mean, you would have expected him to just drop everything and embrace these guys and everybody lives happily ever after. But there's more that needs to happen still. Sometimes, perhaps, reconciliation happens superficially. And underlying issues really are not dealt with fully. And Joseph recognizes that. It's not just about us getting along. It's about the unresolved issue being settled. Joseph recognizes that. For the reader, there's a little bit of suspense. You don't know what's going on. And again, as we see the hand of providence in all of this, I think that the Lord often leaves us with the same questions about his own dealings with us. You probably have felt from time to time, God is speaking kind of roughly to me. He's doing something in my life that hurts. It doesn't make any sense. One of the men that I read on this chapter, he described Joseph's treatment of his brothers as a severe mercy. A severe mercy. Sometimes that's the only kind of mercy that will get our attention and deal with things. If God roughs us up a little bit, not because he likes to see us suffer, but because of our own stubbornness and our own resistance to him. And Joseph is God's agent working that way in the life of these men. Well, it does get more and more intense as it goes along. Reading now verse 8. And Joseph recognized his brothers, but they did not recognize him. And Joseph remembered the dreams that he had dreamed of them. And we want to stop right there. I think one of the reasons Joseph didn't just jump at the chance to be reunited with his family is at this point, when he remembers the dream, this isn't exactly what the dream had said. Because his parents weren't there, and one of his brothers was missing. And so evidently something else has got to happen for the prophecy to be entirely fulfilled. And it's kind of like what we saw earlier with Joseph, when he interprets Pharaoh's dreams, and on the spot he just comes up with this plan for how Pharaoh ought to handle it. And it was a brilliant plan. And on the spot... And I would have to say, using the God-given gifts that he had, he comes up with this brilliant plan to get this thing straightened out totally. And it is a test that he's going to give them as we read on. He said to them, "You are spies. You have come to see the nakedness of the land." They said to him, "No, my lord, your servants have come to buy food. We are all sons of one man." And then one of the greatest ironies of this book is the next line, "We are honest men." Really? We are sons of one man. So, you know, the next breath after talking about their father, they say, "We're honest men." and think about what they did to their father 20 years ago. Your servants have never been spies. Well, that gets things moving, but Joseph recognizes there's still a lot that is not clear here. I'm still fuzzy as to what's happening in their hearts, and I still want more information. He particularly is concerned about his brother. And so he insists, starting in verse 12, "No, it is the nakedness of the land that you have come to see." And they said, "We, your servants, are 12 brothers." In other words, by pressing them, he's kind of teasing out more information than they had given initially. "The sons of one man in the land of Canaan. Behold, the youngest is this day with our father, and one is no more." So they have divulged a little bit more, and thankfully Benjamin is alive. And the last line of their statement is, "One is no more, Joseph." And he's standing right in front of their face. And now the issue is, all right, what is your attitude? What is your thinking about the way you treated me? And so he puts more pressure on them. "Joseph said to them, 'It is as I said to you, you are spies. By this you shall be tested. By the life of Pharaoh, you shall not go from this place unless your youngest brother comes here. Send one of you, and let him bring your brother, while you remain confined, that your words may be tested, whether there is truth in you. Or else, by the life of Pharaoh, surely you are spies.'" And he put them all together in custody for 3 days. Now, as people who are striving to live holy lives, we read this kind of thing, and we have questions about the ethics of what's happening here. Because this is not a true accusation. I don't think he really thought they were spies. And he makes up this charge in order to provide this test opportunity. And the question is, was that right? Is this commendable? Was there some other way? Should I be doing this? Etc., etc. And I would say, let's not be distracted by questions that are not the purpose of the text to answer. I will say God is clearly using this man. I will also say that God himself does certain things that at the front end seem a little strange, such as a test that he himself put Abraham through when he called on him to sacrifice his son, knowing all along that he did not want him to sacrifice his son. And I'm not answering the question because I don't think it's something we can be totally dogmatic about, but I'm just saying, let's keep the focus where it needs to be, and that is, these men, something had to happen to bring out the true condition of their heart. And this was a test that, in the providence of God, Joseph put his brothers to. Sometimes it takes a test to bring us to a point of basically confession. That's what this man is driving at. Verse 18. "On the third day, Joseph said to them..." Can you imagine what it must have felt like spending 3 days in a prison? Again, we might be tempted to look at Joseph and, you know, say, "You're trying to get even. You're trying to make them squirm." I think that's a bit harsh given everything that we know about Joseph. But there certainly is a poetic justice in the fact that they had thrown him in a pit, that he had spent all that time in jail, and now they're having themselves to get a little bit of their own medicine, not really knowing what was going to happen down there in the pit, not knowing that it was going to be 3 days, and their future very uncertain. Humanly speaking, we call that deja vu, right? But believing in the providence of God, I know what's happened to me. I've gone through circumstances And I'm saying to myself, have I been here before? It seems like I was in this precise circumstance. I may not be able to remember exactly everything about it, but it's just, it's very apparent. God sort of takes you through cycles that are designed to work in your life. And that's what he's doing here. But as time goes on and he has more time to think about it, he does come up with a little bit softer plan. Because first he had said, what I want you to do is one of you go and get Benjamin, and the rest of you stay here. And now he says, okay, we'll ease up a little bit. And what we're going to do now is we're going to send most of you, but one of you stay. And I think, again, that shows something of his heart, that his point is not to make them squirm. He's trying to get at the issues, and he's trying to get this thing reconciled. And furthermore, when he speaks to them about this plan, he says, do this and you will live, for I fear God. And I don't see any reason why we shouldn't take him at face value with that statement. And that he is unburdening his heart, that this is something done in the presence of God, for the glory of God. And he mentions God, perhaps as well, to try to get them to start thinking about God. If you are honest men, let one of your brothers remain confined where you are in custody, and let the rest go and carry grain for the famine of your households. And bring your youngest brother to me, so your words will be verified, and you shall not die. And they did so, meaning they began to do so. But before they actually leave, there is this conversation that, in God's mercy, begins to show us the test is working. Things are happening deep down in their hearts, and those 3 days now there have had the desired effect. In truth, we are guilty concerning our brother, in that we saw the distress of his soul when he begged us, and we did not listen. That is why this distress has come upon us. Amazing. Joseph didn't suggest those words to them. That was a guilty conscience speaking. And even though, as we tried to emphasize this morning, our motive and our power for the Christian life is not guilt, it is God's grace and the power of the cross, still one of the things God does to sanctify us is to speak to us through our conscience, particularly when we have violated his will. And it is an act of mercy for him to go after us by the accusations of our conscience. Who knows what kind of turmoil of soul these men have experienced for the last 20 years. Whether they had just been dead into it, we're not sure. But God brought them to a crisis moment, a particular test, to bring out this confession. And again, that was an act of mercy. For God to bring us to confession, it's not because he likes to see us squirm in the dust. This is, I don't want to sound too psychological, but it is therapeutic. For us to own up, that is the way to spiritual health. It is to own up to failed responsibility. And God does that in their lives. Verse 22. It gets more amazing. Reuben answered them, did I not tell you not to sin against the boy? But you did not listen. So now there comes a reckoning for his blood. And you may remember back in chapter 37 that Reuben actually had been the one to tell them to put him in the pit because he intended to rescue him. And unbeknownst to him, they end up selling him. And so he says, I told you so. And perhaps they'd had this conversation before. Knowing brothers, they probably have. But sometimes you really do need to say, I told you so. And God is speaking to people sometimes that way. And again, to demonstrate Joseph's heart in the matter, verse 23 says, "They did not know that Joseph understood them, for there was an interpreter between them. Then he turned away from them and wept. And he returned to them and spoke to them. And he took Simeon from them and bound him before their eyes." And let's stop there for a moment. Why did he choose to bind Simeon? According to the customs of the day, the one who was responsible for what happened in a case like this would have been the firstborn. But Joseph got a little bit of information through Reuben's confession that he did not know before. Evidently, he did not know that Reuben was actually trying to save him. And so, he does something out of the ordinary here, and instead of keeping the firstborn, he says, "All right, Reuben can go. I'm going to get the secondborn, Simeon." Because Simeon, as the secondborn, who was there when Judah came up with the idea to sell him, he would have had the primary responsibility. He was the next in command. And he gave in. And of course, we know some other negative things about Simeon, because it was he and Levi who in chapter 34 went and massacred all those people at Shechem. And you see again the justice of God putting this man in a place of discipline. And Joseph gave orders to fill their bags with grain and to replace every man's money in his sack and to give them provisions for the journey. This was done for them. Then they loaded their donkeys with their grain and departed. Now, we're going to go on to verse 27 and start the section there because it reflects something of their trip as they get to Canaan. And what you begin to see there is a little bit different emphasis from what's come before. We said, first of all, that adversity initiates the reconciliation. We've seen here that testing precedes it and really brings to the fore the issues of the heart that were standing in the way of reconciliation. And now, although the brothers are moving forward and they're responding correctly, what you're going to find by the time you get to the end of the chapter is really pretty disappointing. And that is that people's selfishness delays reconciliation. Not thinking primarily of the brothers at this point, but thinking about their father, Jacob. What happens as they make their way? Verse 27, "As one of them opened his sack to give his donkey fodder at the lodging place, he saw his money in the mouth of his sack. And he said to his brothers, 'My money has been put back. Here it is in the mouth of my sack.' At this, their hearts failed them, and they turned trembling to one another, saying, 'What is this that God has done to us?'" Money. They had received money in exchange for their brother. They had sold him. They had profited financially. And now, again, history sort of repeats itself, sometimes in odd ways. Joseph puts the money back. And here they're staring, at least at this point, one of them is staring at this money. And again, it's used of God to bring them to an awareness that something else is going on here. This isn't just about food and some guy who thinks we're spies for no reason. This is about God. Somehow God is involved in this. These people's conscience is awakened to the providence of God, particularly because they're guilty. And that's a good thing. That shows that the Lord is at work and people are responding. Now, you think about the money, say, why did Joseph do that? Well, one, it seems that would have put a little bit, even more pressure on them to go back. Because, in fact, if they had kept this money, I really would have put their character in question. And he just throws in, again, very brilliant guy, throws in this other aspect to get them to come back in order to defend their honor. And it actually gets more intense as you go on and you read a little bit later. Let's go ahead and read in verse 29. When they came back to Jacob, their fatherland of Canaan, they told him all that had happened to them, saying, "The man, the Lord of the land, spoke roughly to us and took us to be spies of the land. But we said to him, 'We're honest men. We've never been spies. We're 12 brothers, sons of our father. One is no more. The youngest is to stay with our father in the land of Canaan.' Then the man, the Lord of the land, said to us, 'By this I shall know that you're honest men. Leave one of your brothers with me. Take grain for the family of your households and go your way. Bring your youngest brother to me. Then I shall know that you are not spies, but honest men, and I will deliver your brother to you, and you shall trade in the land.'" So they summarize the story. And now, verse 35, as they emptied their sacks, behold, every man's bundle of money was in his sack. And when they and their father saw their bundles of money, they were afraid. And reading this for the first time, you're just, what in the world is happening here? And you're saying, they've got to go back. I mean, this is, you realize the military force that Joseph has at his disposal. And these guys are accused of being spies, and now they're looking like just total thieves as well. He's got their brother over there. I mean, what's going to happen to them? It's really all up to Jacob. And Jacob, their father, said to them, "You have bereaved me of my children. Joseph is no more, and Simeon is no more. And now you would take Benjamin. All this has come against me." Now, we don't want to be unsympathetic toward Jacob. This man had suffered a great deal. And what he's saying here is all true. But again, the author is choosing to give you certain of the words he spoke in order to indicate to you what really was his burden, what was his concern. When you think about Joseph evidently dying and Simeon being down there, and now the possibility of Benjamin, doesn't it seem like he might have better said, all of this has come against them? In other words, he was still alive. He was fine. And he's concerned about how people's suffering affects me. Okay. All these things are against me. Well, Reuben tries to intercede, and at this point we see one reason why Reuben was not really qualified to be the leader of these tribes eventually. And he says, "Kill my two sons if I do not bring him back to you. Put him, that is Benjamin, in my hands, and I will bring him back to you." How was that supposed to help? Kill my two sons if I don't bring them back to you. I mean, it seems like that would just be adding insult to injury. You're putting your own sons on the line. Somehow that's going to make him feel better if Benjamin is lost. And the reason we're a little bit hard on Reuben at this point is because of the way that eventually in chapter 43, Judah responds. Go with me to chapter 43 and verse 8. We'll get to this chapter later, but it says there, "Judah said to Israel, his father, 'Send the boy with me, and we will arise and go, that we may live and not die, both we and you, and also our little ones. I will be a pledge of his safety. From my hand you shall require him. If I do not bring him back to you and set him before you, then let me bear the blame forever.'" Isn't that a lot nobler way to try to work things out? You're saying, look, you can hold me personally accountable. Offering your sons really is no help at all. But this man is taking personal responsibility. And through these years, as we will go on to see, God has been working some wonderful things in Judah's character that are going to put him in a position, even though he's not the firstborn, and even though he's not even Joseph, to ultimately be the leader among the tribes. So Reuben shows, at the least here, lack of wisdom, and perhaps selfishness as well, but the selfishness idea, I think we see mostly in Jacob as the chapter ends. He said, my son shall not go down with you, for his brother is dead and he is the only one left. If harm should happen to him on the journey that you are to make, you would bring down my gray hairs with sorrow to Sheol, meaning the grave. Well, what are the alternatives? If you don't go back, you're all going to starve to death. Okay. Again, what good at the end of the day is it going to do to hang on to Benjamin, because he's the one I love? If you take him and something happens to him, it's just going to cause me to die in grief. Well, if you don't, the whole bunch of you are going to die in grief. And again, I believe this is reflecting something of the heart of this man. I mean, we have seen him grow a great deal. But God is going to have to work even more to get some further growth and to get him to see the way that his selfishness is affecting other people. And as I'm saying here, it's actually delaying the reconciliation. They should have turned right around and dealt with this issue. But because Jacob dug in, because of what was important to him, things get pretty serious. And it's only after the kind of pressure that Judah puts on him that he finally gives in. Now, if you stop there, as we're going to do tonight, there is some uncertainty. And I think the author is trying to leave you hanging, like, you know, what's going to happen here? And to leave you frustrated with Jacob, because all that you're seeing from him is this self-pity. I was looking at a sermon that a man preached on this passage, and he took the little chorus, "Jesus loves me, this I know," and turned it around to try to get at what was happening in Jacob's life. And he says, "No one loves me, this I know, my misfortunes tell me so." And that is such a human way of thinking, that because things have gone bad, it's just hopeless, and God has forgotten me, the whole world's against me, there's no solution to this thing, woe is me. That's where you're left with Jacob as you come to the end of the chapter. Now, all throughout that time, Simeon is down there, and his life is in the balances, and if the reader is hanging in suspense, think about Simeon down there. Jacob evidently wasn't that concerned about that problem. Thankfully, things do go on to get resolved, but we're going to stop there, and we're going to try to end, as we do, sort of wrapping this up and connecting it with everything else in Genesis and trying to appreciate the application of this for us. I started by saying this is talking about God's redemptive plan on the horizontal level of reconciling people at odds with each other. And when you read Genesis, you see the effects of sin in all kinds of ways, but this business of how sin messes up the family is really a huge theme in Genesis. Cain kills Abel. And then it gets worse with Lamech in the next generation. You've got the whole world eventually destroyed, and Noah, this one godly family, is preserved through that, and that family is torn apart by the sins of Ham. Abraham. You got the problem with Hagar. And then as a result of that, you've got Ishmael versus Isaac. And then, of course, you've got Esau versus Jacob. And then you have the sons of Jacob. The more people are multiplied, the more this kind of tension is multiplied. So you want to be thinking not just of God's work to get this one family back together, but this is here as a model, really, of what God does redemptively in the lives of his people to reconcile them with others of his people with whom, because of sin, they are at odds. And that was a message that the descendants of those 12 men who were reading this for the first time really needed to hear. Because throughout the Old Testament, it doesn't stop with Genesis, there is a good bit of infighting among the tribes. Things are very solid and things are very stable through the period of the conquest. And probably the Lord used these stories to get these people united, working together. But shortly after, you get the book of Judges, there is civil war, there's all this ambition and all this strife, and eventually the kingdom is split apart into two. In other words, God is getting a message out to the descendants of these people. This is what sin does. And part of my redemption is to bring back together my people who are at odds with each other because of sin. Now, of course, we are the latest installment of the people of God. And let me have you go to one passage in the Gospel of Matthew that I have wrestled with in thinking about the application of this story. When you think about the delay there because of selfishness, look at Matthew 5, Jesus' teaching in verse 23. So if you are offering your gift at the altar, and there remember that your brother has something against you, leave your gift there before the altar and go. First, be reconciled to your brother, and then come and offer your gift. You see how God values immediacy, speed when it comes to brothers in Christ being reconciled with each other? Do you see how it displeases him when there is this division? And how, from the very beginning, he's showing that through the gospel, these things can be worked through to a resolution and peace restored. Just like this morning, I was pointing out, sanctification is part of salvation. We could use that same phrase for this. Reconciliation among the people of God is also part of God's redemptive plan. Or to put it in these terms, God's redemption reconciles us to other believers as well as to himself. Now, I'm not saying this tonight because I know that people are at odds with each other. Well, you know whatever it is that God is bringing to your conscience. But I'm just pointing out that this is the lesson that God would have us be struck with from this chapter. And it is something I'm sure that all of us are going to be needing at some point. Because given our fallenness, stuff happens. And the point is, don't delay. Deal with it. Don't allow your idolatry, your selfishness to keep you from experiencing this aspect of the gospel. That relationships can be restored. Now, the other side of it, particularly if we do delay, yes, God's redemption reconciles us to other believers as well as to himself. But we ought to be warned that this process may be painful, particularly if we put it off, particularly if we dig in and we're stubborn like some of these people were. May the Lord help us to respond immediately and to have a heart for peace and for experiencing the reconciliation that only the gospel can bring.